So today we welcome to the program Ashley Mulcahy and James Peretta, and they make up the musical ensemble here in Quincy called Lyrical, which is an interesting, basically new group that features an instrument that I'd never heard of before called the viol, and how the viol and voice work together dating back to the colonial time. So Ashley and James, very nice to meet you both. Thanks for spending some time with us.
Thanks for having us.
Great to be here.
Yeah, it's really interesting. You'd reached out after performing at the Dorothy Quincy Homestead here in Quincy in the old kitchen, as it were. And it was the first time that I had ever been exposed to your form of music and about your group as well. So maybe if you first could tell us a little bit about yourselves. Maybe Ashley, you could start with you if that's okay.
Sure. So I'm Ashley Mulcahy. I'm a classically trained singer. I'm a mezzo-soprano, which means that on the spectrum of classically trained women's voices, I have a lower voice. James and I met when we were undergraduates at the University of Michigan. I studied voice performance and Italian. And then I went on to get a master's in voice performance, specializing in early music at the Yale School of Music and Institute of Sacred Music. I finished that in 2019. And then we moved here to Quincy 6 months before the pandemic, so.
What was it that attracted you, brought you to Quincy? How did that transition happen?
So we, so you may not know this, but the Boston area is kind of considered North America's early music capital. So we were really keen on coming to the Boston area. We love the city. And when we were looking for places to live, Quincy just ticked all of our boxes. I mean, it's, you know, relatively affordable, great public transit, access to the city, but also a lot of access to nature. You know, there's Nut Island and Blue Hills Reservation and very walkable downtown and a relatively diverse community. So we really enjoyed ourselves here.
And an excellent gelato place downtown as well.
Yes, we love Cafe Gelato.
The city leaders will be really happy to hear how you've described the city and what attracted you to it, because that has really been their goal, you know, for the past 30 plus years in the redevelopment effort. So, you know, folks like you are a living example of the fact that it is working. Where are you from originally, Ashley?
I grew up on Long Island, on the South Shore, a 45-minute train ride to Penn Station.
Oh, okay. And James, what's your story?
Yeah, so I grew up in St. Louis, Missouri, and started playing the cello in fourth grade with my elementary school's music program, and also studying with a private teacher. I kept studying cello through middle school and through high school, and then like late middle school, early high school, I started getting really serious about it. And decided that I wanted to go to music school to study cello. I did the audition circuit and ended up going to the University of Michigan, which it's funny because sort of as a cellist, I was really just focused on who the cello teacher is. But it turns out that University of Michigan also had a lot of other great stuff going on. One of those things is, a bit of an early music scene. There isn't really a program for early music at Michigan. Yeah. But there were enough teachers and interested students that, you know, there was a Baroque orchestra that I started playing in, and a teacher who you could take private either Baroque cello or viol lessons with. Sometime during my sophomore year, I started taking Baroque cello lessons with her. Eventually, you know, got exposed to the viol a little bit more and decided that I wanted to start studying the viol as well. And at this point I'm totally hooked on the viol, and it's my main instrument and I love it so much. And it's really well suited to what we do together. Comparing the Baroque cello to the viol in terms of what you can do with it in Baroque and Renaissance music, there's a good amount of stuff that you can do with the cello, but there's a lot more for the viol. There's a lot more music written specifically for the viol, and the way it's set up. So the viol, it actually comes in different sizes. The bass viol is about the same size as a cello, but it has 6 strings instead of 4. And it has frets on the fingerboard, similar to what you'd see on a guitar, except these frets are strands of dried gut meaning sheep intestines usually, mm-hmm. Which is the same material that the strings are made out of for a viol or a baroque cello. And so between the strings, the tuning and easier to play chords on the instrument, like if you were playing the guitar or the lute. And so that just opens a lot more possibilities over what is possible on the cello.
So which came first, the viol or the cello?
I have to tread lightly here. But what I can tell you for sure is that they developed separately. So it's not that one is a predecessor for the other. The viol, there was its ancestor instrument originated in Spain, and then that traveled to Italy, and then the Italians made modifications to it to make it more like what we think of the viol as now. And then that actually went back to Spain. Whereas the cello comes from an instrument that they called the bass violin, which looks almost exactly the same as a cello. It's a tiny bit smaller and it's tuned differently. So I couldn't necessarily pinpoint for you like what's the like which happened first, but you know they developed separately from each other. But by the time we get to the Renaissance, you would have had the cello and the viol da gamba, the viol, both having developed.
Okay. Interestingly, though, James, you have a background in computer science and engineering, so.
I do. So, yeah, it's always interesting telling about my time at University of Michigan, because there were like a bunch of different things happening at once, but that lead me in 2 very different directions. So another thing that I discovered about University of Michigan is that it has one of the best computer science programs in the country, which I had no idea when I was auditioning there. But I had some room in my schedule to take a non-music class for fun. And I had kind of been into like math and physics in high school, but was a little bit rusty at that point. And talked to some of the other cellists in my studio, 2 of whom were double majors in cello and physics. And they suggested that I take an intro programming class and pointed me in the right direction. So I took that course. And then the next year, I really enjoyed that course. And so then the next year I took another computer science class, really enjoyed that, and decided maybe I should try to get a minor in computer science before I leave here. Then spent a summer taking a couple of required courses for the minor, and ended up spending so much time on it that I figured, what the heck, this is great. I might as well just stay here longer and do a double major. And so I ended up doing a bachelor's in science in computer science. And then after that, I went in to do a master's in computer science, which I finished in 2019. It was convenient that we finished our master's degrees at the same time and then could just move to Boston together.
Yes, sure. So how did Lyrical come along? And we should spell it for folks also, because it's not in the traditional spelling that they would think of, right?
Yeah, Lyracle.
Right.
So the name sort of comes from the lyra, so the kind of like harp-like or bowed instrument with a lot of strings that, like in Greek mythology, mm-hmm. Orpheus played. And so taking that word plus just, it's lyrical.
Yeah, I mean, so there was also a type of viol called right. the lyra viol.
Yeah, right. Which was imitating that style of playing.
And then, it seemed appropriate for a voice and viol instrument because, of course, a voice and viol ensemble, because of course vocal music has lyrics. So it was kind of a
oh, okay.
We're trying to think of a name that would you know, speak to both the voice and the vinyl aspect of the group. And that's what we came up with. So
about 2018, you started the ensemble. How did that, you know, how did that come to be? What was the discussion around, hey, let's, you know, form this ensemble and start performing, you know, voice and viol music around the greater Boston area?
So I guess it really, I think, first came out of the desire to play with each other more. So, you know, James's first instrument, like you mentioned, was the cello, and there aren't so many possibilities for just cello and voice on their own. But when he started to really get good at the viol, you know, that opened a lot of possibilities for collaboration. And, you know, James and I wear various hats in the group, but the hat that I wear aside from singer is researcher. Yes. So, you know, I started reading a lot, and we learned about this practice, this historical practice of accompanying a single voice or solo voice with just one viol, and became really interested in that. And both of us also share a desire, I guess, to kind of seek out things that are maybe at the margins of the musical canon and try to push the musical canon of standard repertoire a little bit. And the practice of accompanying a solo voice with just one viol, you know, isn't really done so much. And a lot of that repertoire isn't even written down. So that really appealed to us, and that's been our focus for the last 2 years, of course, also for practical considerations. but we are in the process of becoming a 501c3 with the help of the Boston College Community Enterprise Law Clinic. And we hope that will allow us to eventually expand, incorporate more viol players, more singers, but I think we'll always do some programming that's just one voice and one viol. So
as a 501c3, a nonprofit, to what goal? To bring in students perhaps, performances for organizations? What's the thought, you know, for the future?
Yeah, I mean, probably bringing in other professionals.
Okay.
And something that we had started to put our feelers out for before the pandemic is, mm-hmm. you know, taking some of our programs and presenting them at universities, mm-hmm. For humanities students or yeah. other disciplines, music and non-music.
Or on our own concert series. And, you know, those kind of things would require, you know, a more robust organization. And I think kind of the way to achieve that is through the non-for-profit model, you know, that allows you to grow your ensemble.
The Quincy Viol Society, perhaps, or something like that?
Why not?
Yes, there is already there's the Viola da Gamba Society of America, and then there's a New England chapter of the Viola da Gamba Society, which is fairly active.
Do you want to tell them about powers and how you have powers?
Oh yeah, so I actually teach viola da gamba at the Powers Music School out in Belmont. And I'm the second viol teacher at that music school. when we were getting ready to move here, we had played at the Viola da Gamba Society sponsored concert on the Boston Early Music Festival Fringe Festival, which is fun to say. so I had to borrow an instrument from someone, and I was talking to this viol player and mentioned, you know, like I really enjoy teaching, like, you know, what's the teaching scene like around here? And she said, well, the school that I'm teaching at is actually looking for another viol teacher to pick up students who can't fit into her schedule. So they interviewed me and hired me. And I have 4 students, which doesn't sound like a lot, but for viol, that's quite a lot.
The fact that they had so many viol students that they needed a second viol teacher is just like...
is really special, yeah.
So Boston, yeah. Where else?
We really, you know, tapped into an underground, viol happening here, yeah.
Especially compared to when I was at University of Michigan, if I wanted to have a group of viol players to play in consort together, I had to, you know, convince my friends to learn the viol, basically.
Well, I guess it kind of makes sense, you know, here we're a colonial era, you know, Boston certainly is, you know, the founding of the country. And you would think that, you know, music that came over from England would start in this area of the country. So I guess that's, you know, not totally surprising. The fact that young people such as yourselves are so interested in it and are bringing some of the oldest types of music, you know, here in the 2020, 2021 era, I think is a story worth telling.
Yeah, thank you. Yeah, it's interesting to think about because the evolution of like what we now refer to as classical music, there are huge dramatic differences between what music was like in the Renaissance and what classical music is like now. Mm. It might as well be a completely different genre of music. The priorities have shifted so much and the musical styles. I mean, like the music that we do is really made for smaller spaces, whereas modern classical music today is meant for, you know, big spaces like, you know, like Symphony Hall. Mm-hmm. And the way that, you know, the way that, the Renaissance music sounds compared to, well, of course, contemporary classical music is intentionally like, you know, just doing whatever you can, but even compared to, you know, like romantic music or early 20th century music, just the way that Renaissance music sounds and feels is so different, like a lot of times, and in some ways some of the like musical language almost has some of the musical language of Renaissance music almost has more in common with some popular music today than classical music that we hear today.
Yeah. You performed at the Dorothy Quincy Homestead in the kitchen, right? Which was a part of the original structure of the property. So how did that performance come to be?
Oh, yeah. That was such a cool experience. So we, you know, with the onset of the pandemic, we pretty much did not leave Quincy and really got a chance just to, you know, explore things that we were kind of too busy to explore around here during the first 6 months of our time here when we were, you know, both starting new jobs and I was trying to get freelance work and all these things, and just became really interested in the local. And, you know, we were curious if there is any, if we could find out anything about, you know, the viol in 17th century, well, we started with Quincy and then we expanded, you know, to Massachusetts. And it kind of just grew out of a desire to, you know, connect what we do to our community. Yeah. And also, you know, so, okay. So we're trying to figure out something about the history of the viol and music making and Massachusetts and local. And you know, we thought, all right, well, the viol was a hugely popular instrument for amateur musicians in England, you know, at home playing. Mm-hmm. And was that the case here? And we found some evidence that it was, and it just seemed to fit so perfectly because with the pandemic, you know, all we've been doing is making music in our apartment and in our home. And we wanted to connect that experience to a larger historical and local narrative. So we started reaching out to the, you know, historic homes here in Quincy. And the women who look after the Quincy Homestead were so excited about the idea. And they just, you know, were really wonderful to work with and gave us access to record that music in the Quincy Homestead. And, you know, as Americans, it was a really rare and special experience to record 17th century music in a space that is a 17th century space. You know, I know they're abundant in Europe, but not so much here. So, you know, playing music that was really fitting for that space in a historical way was just so special. And, you know, we hope to one day be able to do that with
a live audience.
A live audience. You know, this was just us and a camera guy who was, you know.
Yeah, that's what I wanted to ask, actually. You know, post pandemic, what do you envision for Lyrical?
Yeah, I mean, we're absolutely gonna do some concerts in spaces in Quincy, definitely at the Homestead. What's the name of the church in?
We have to save.
Right, that's another thing. But
we're going to explore possibilities.
So. There are some really cool spaces. There are really cool historic spaces that we would love to play in.
Hopefully when we're a 501c3, we can grow the ensemble and, you know, continue playing on existing concert series. But we'd also like to start our own concert series, and it would be great if possible to do that somewhere here in Quincy. Right now, like we mentioned, this is such a hot spot for music pre-1700, but to the best of our knowledge, not much of that activity happens in Quincy, mm-hmm. Which is a pity because it is happening in places that are equidistant from Boston and transit accessible, like Brookline or Cambridge or Newton. So it'd be great to have some of that going on here too, since it is such a particular thing to this area.
Yeah, well, I don't see why not. Absolutely, you can be part of the renaissance of the city of Quincy, for sure. One of the overriding themes that's been coming up as we've been chatting is you're both curious. I keep hearing curiosity. So do you consider yourselves also, in addition to musicians, musical historians?
The terminology is a little bit tricky. We don't want to put ourselves in a particular box, but we're sort of, we're somewhere in between, pure performance and pure music history or musicology.
It's tricky. I would not call myself a scholar. I do not have a PhD. There are people who have PhDs in musicology and are musicologists, right, and have a level of specialty and a skill set that I do not have. Mm-hmm. But I would call myself a scholarly singer. And we're both very interested in something called historically informed performance, which is the idea. I mean, it is pretty much what it says it is. The idea that history and research is informing your musical choices and the way you approach your musical production and performance, if that makes any sense.
Yeah, no, I understand. Yeah, putting it in context of when it was new, right?
Yeah, exactly. So for instrumentalists, it's a little bit easier because, we can have someone make a replica of those old instruments, and the instruments can teach us a lot about how they're supposed to be played. There are also tons and tons of treatises from a period where, people wrote about how you're supposed to play the instrument, or how you're supposed to play music, or how you're supposed to write music. Mm-hmm. And those treatises range from helpful to not very helpful. Okay. some of these writers like to go on tangents that aren't exactly helpful to to someone who's trying to figure out, what should I do with, my bow?
Okay.
But yeah, it's interesting.
Yeah, I think something you mentioned are being curious. I think something that really appeals to us is in this practice is where, history and research meets imagination, because you read about these things and you research these things and trying to put together a program based on what you research. And there are inevitably, especially in the kind of repertoire we do, as opposed to more, later things that are still considered early music, like Bach or Handel, for example, mm-hmm. about which we as a society know much more. There are so many gaps in the research. You find these tiny little fragments that are never enough information. So then the idea to us is not to recreate, but what was, but rather to use those fragments of information and fact and history and fill in the gaps with our imagination to create a musical performance and an experience for our listeners.
Okay, but you're not writing music, right? Actually, you're just performing, you're not writing.
Yeah, so with what we do, like we mentioned earlier, a lot of the music that people would have played for Voice and Bio wasn't written down. And so, my hat is the group is I have studied lots of, you know, 16th century counterpoint, like the compositional style. And my job would be to take something that's written for, you know, four voices and arrange it for one voice and one viol, which is something that we know they did. There's a treatise that talks about doing this. It doesn't say much about it, but it says that
it gives an example,
yeah. But we don't have the original madrigal, so it's hard to see what he actually did with it. So there is some creativity that comes there, but you know, everything that I'm doing is informed by what I know about compositional style from the period.
Yep.
So we're not trying to create like exactly what was, but we're trying to create like what maybe kind of probably would have happened.
Okay. All right. Okay.
As best as we can tell.
Yeah.
Plausible.
So when you're able to perform, you know, in front of live audiences again, what would you want your audience to kind of take away from a performance by Lyrical? You know, what is it you'd hope that they get from it?
I think overall just that it's great music.
Okay. That's not a bad thing, right? It's entertainment.
Yeah. No, I mean,
yeah, it's not, you know, I just want people to like it. And if, you know, if they learn something about the history too, that's great.
Okay.
Yeah, I mean, you know, you want to create a program that's enjoyable and accessible to someone who has not done hundreds of hours of reading about this stuff like we have.
Yeah.
You know, but I think it's also just great to expose people to a range of human musical expressions. And this is one that people may not be, you know, so familiar with.
Mm-hmm.
And it's great just to say, you know, hey, this is like another way that people have expressed themselves or expressed, you know, whatever ideas through music.
Yeah.
We really like it. And we hope you will too.
Would you talk to your audience, you know, during performances to kind of explain the music? Yeah.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. So that ranges from like, you know, talking about the pieces to like sort of weaving a historical narrative. So
yes.
Our recent program centered around this Italian viol player, Tarquinia Mozza. And so throughout the program, you know, we're sort of saying little, yeah.
Oh, very good.
Yeah, she was a viol player and a singer, and she accompanied her own singing on the viol. And so, you know, between, you know, the sets on the program, we, you know, would include sort of narrative about her life and her career.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
And it depends a lot on the audience too. You know, we've done some performances for very general audiences, and then some for, you know, other really nerdy early music people.
Yeah.
And that very much dictates, you know,
sure.
the kinds of things we say about the music. So.
Yeah, I get you, yeah. You don't happen to have a viols handy you could show us, do you, James? Aha! Just kind of give folks a sense for what it's like.
Okay.
So this is real life television, folks. Ashley, let me ask you, do you have any performance plan post-pandemic already? Like, you know, something that you really want to share with folks?
Yeah, I mean, it's, you know, I'm one of the choral scholars at Marsh Chapel at Boston University. So I really hope to be getting back to that as soon as the pandemic's over. That's been wonderful in the 6 months I was able to do it. You know, I do have some things on my calendar that are tentative for me, you know, personally, just depending on what happens with the pandemic.
Right.
And then, you know, James and I also, as Lyrical, have a concert that was supposed to happen this past year that had to be postponed. So we'll see.
Right.
I guess.
Yeah. Okay. Okay. Yes. Show and tell.
So here I have my bass viol.
Okay.
So those are the frets on the neck, and you can see it has.
See that? Yep.
And this is my treble viol, which you can see is a lot smaller.
Okay.
Still 6 feet, still has frets. One of the cool things about these instruments. One of the cool things about these instruments is that sort of the craftsmanship tends to be more artistic than what you see on, you know, typical cellos, violins.
Let's see, do I have the direction right?
Yeah, on the back of the peg box here,
we have this carving of this sea monster and flowers. So carvings, you know, of things like this or flowers or other designs are very common on viols. You can also see the scroll is carved out rather than a solid piece.
Yes.
Sometimes you can see heads on the scrolls, like a demon head or a this or that Greek god, or I think the queen in some cases.
Oh, interesting.
But yeah, the instruments are very, very artistically made.
Beautiful.
And they match, you know, one interesting thing is that there's kind of a size of viol that corresponds with different voice parts, you know, so the treble viol, which he just showed you, you know, would correspond with a soprano, you know, highest female okay. voice range, although it is a bit more expansive than the voice and range. But, you know, there is a size of the voice that corresponds with the alto voice and the tenor voice and sure. the bass voice,
sure.
et cetera.
Saxophones are similar, right? The different sounds yeah. are different
sure,
sizes.
Sure, sure. Yeah. So, you know, there is a lot of music that you can do in which you kind of have a vocal choir and a choir of viols, so to speak.
A consort.
Yeah, well.
yeah. Interesting. Yeah. Anything else you'd like folks to know about Lyrical right now?
I guess that's it. I mean, we do have a website, lyricalmusic.com,
okay.
and they can find us on Facebook and Instagram and YouTube and all that. And you know, if they're interested in our work, it's out there. Anything else?
I really appreciate your time. It's been a lot of fun learning and talking to you both, and hopefully we'll get to see you perform live very, very soon here in Quincy.
Thank you for having us.
Thank you very much.
It's our pleasure. Okay, be well.
Thank you. Thanks.